Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. The time is 1:45 p.m. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the General LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, Representative Kirka, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 109, Extend Bar Association Board of Governors, sponsored by my office. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. At this time, we will take up amendments to House Bill 109. I'd like to put on record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. Our office received two amendments for House Bill 109. The amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we'll take questions. Then we will proceed to discussion with each member, limited to 3 minutes. Finally, the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the back. And we'll begin with amendment number one, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move amendment one.
Objection for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Appreciate it. I am passing out a little flyer that we put together, which deals with amendment number one. And in section 808050, we have an apportionment scheme for how the members are selected based on judicial district, between the four judicial districts. And that was originally put together into law in the 50s. It's had some slight amendment, but has remained unchanged as far as this proportion scheme since 1971, according to the legislative library. It did some research for us on that. And so the amendment here recognizes that that system is somewhat dated, and that there may be on occasion a desire to update that for population changes, demographic changes, and so forth. 50 years is a long time to keep that kind of apportionment scheme in statute. Also recognizes that this is an issue that the legislature, for better or for worse, is responsible for, because we put it into state law, and we told the board that they would be required to select their members in this way. And so this isn't something that the board can really do anything about, because we put it in state law. And the amendment gives them the opportunity going forward to be able to consider and talk about whether or not they want to amend or change the way that their board is selected. It doesn't require them to do so, but it does give them that opportunity, and I think that will allow and facilitate discussion from within the board and within the bar membership on whether or not those changes should be made. But right now, it's the legislature who is directing and basically silencing that conversation. Thank you.
And I would note for members, to the extent there's interest, in addition, we have Ms. Curtis is in the room, the legislative auditor, also Ben Hoffmeister, president of the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association, is on Teams and available for questions. Phil Shanahan, bar counsel from the Bar Association, is also online, as well as Daniel Bailey, executive director of the Alaska Bar Association, all here to, if you have questions for them. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I think a question for, anyone from the Bar Association, their thoughts on this amendment.
Looks like Ms. Bailey is ready to take the first run at that.
Through the chair, Danielle Bailey, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Bar Association. One thing I can comment on is that we did look into the history of the population, of the proportion of attorney members in each judicial district, and we found that over the past 20 years, it has been very consistent. And so at this time, I don't think this amendment would be necessary, just based on population changes and attorney representation.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I'm not sure I understood that. can you say a little bit more?
Sorry. To further explain through the chair, right now, currently, about 11% of the active attorney members in Alaska practice in Judicial District Number 1, which is generally Southeast Alaska. Only 1% practice in Judicial District Number 2. Around 76% practice in Judicial District Number 3, and 9% practice in Judicial District Number 4. And we went through and looked back as far as our records could see, and going back in 2002, those records are pretty consistent, that proportion of numbers in each area is about the same and has been for the past 20 years.
Follow
Does that provide more clarification?
Representative Christ Tompkins, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I that makes sense, and I think maybe the implication is because the ratios have been relatively static, you don't see a need for, at this time, flexibility to alter the ratio of members on the board from different geographies.
Through the chair, that's correct. Perhaps Ben Hoffmeister can speak more to the historical representation of coming from Juneau and some of the more rural locations, but it has been communicated to us through the board that that is something that would wish to remain the same.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have a follow-up question for Mr. Hoffmeister, Representative Christ Tompkins, or do you want him just to weigh in?
I think if Mr. Hoffmeister could weigh in, that would be welcome.
Ben Hoffmeister, the Alaska Bar Association Bar President for 2021. Through the chair to Representative Christ Tompkins. What I can say is that we have had a fairly consistent board in terms of representation, and having practiced throughout the state, what I can say is that dilution of the other judicial districts, I think, would really do a disservice to our membership. I can just say personally, I've learned a lot from the members of the Board of Governors that hail from other parts of the state besides Anchorage and the 3rd Judicial District. And that's not to say, I mean, my colleagues that are from the 3rd Judicial District are tremendous individuals as well. But I'm thinking of, you know, Brent Bennett, who is who's now a Superior Court judge, and he was a former Fairbanks representative. He was somebody that I learned a lot from about my current role. And just about how the board works, Susan Cox and Blake Chupka from Ketchikan, Susan Cox from Juneau. Again, these are people that served together from the 1st Judicial District, and I think that they did offer a lot, and they offer a different perspective. And I think it's easy for lawyers to say this to a group that's making decisions about, you know, the way the Bar Association works, and whether it's something you can appreciate or not. I know Representative Klayman probably could, because he has practiced in Alaska before, but things are very different around the state in terms of local practices, in terms of the way that local bars interact with one another. So where you hail from in Sitka and what happens in Judge Pate's courtroom is going to be different than, you know, what happens in Judge Bennett's courtroom in Fairbanks or in Judge Miller's courtroom in Anchorage. And those differences are unique, and they provide, for the people that practice in front of them, they provide insight, I think, when it comes down to the Board of Governors. So I think that the way we have it structured right now really doesn't, you know, I don't think that restructuring it in the way that as suggested by Representative Eastman is necessary, as Ms. Bailey said. I actually don't think it's required as well, and I think if you ask Mr. Shanahan, our bar counsel, about that, he can provide some more information. But I think that we have a very good representation of the 3rd Judicial District. And on top of that, all of our, you know, we have no geographic restrictions in terms of public members. And currently all our public members are from Anchorage, the Anchorage area as well. That hasn't always been the case since I've been on the board. We had one member who just left, Bill Gordon, who was from the Fairbanks area. But you know, there's three other members that are on the board that are come through in a different, that are elected in a different process or appointed in through a different process, but they still represent, I think, the ideals of the third judicial district. So I echo what Ms. Bailey said. I don't think that there's anything else that needs to be changed.
I had a question for Representative Eastman, maker of the amendment. By this amendment, you would essentially give power away from the legislature and let the Board of Governors, by regulation, decide how to apportion its members. Is there some problem with the legislature having made this decision? Is there some risk with what the legislature has done? That's the first question. And the second question was, why would we give up that power as legislature?
Sure, and I can answer that. Can we continue with the conversation with the members from the bar first?
Well, you get to answer my question first because I'm chair, and then we can go back to questions for the board.
Okay. So the answer to the question about the legislature and power is the Bar Association is a private organization, and I realize that, you know, a previous legislature decided to be very specific in telling the Bar Association, you know, how they were to conduct their affairs, at least as far as the way that they, you know, select their board members and so forth. I'm not sure that's beneficial. The scheme that we have right now, you know, throws two judicial districts together and basically says that, you know, those two judicial districts are, you know, under 08-08-50, they are only allowed to have two members. Well, the third, to be specific, the third judicial district can have two members, the first judicial district can have one member, and from the second and fourth judicial district, they're combined and they only have one member each. What the amendment would do is it would allow the board to separate those districts, for example. It's not recommending that they do that, so I want to be clear. I'm not asking them to adopt a particular scheme, and the amendment doesn't intend to propose one. But under the amendment, they could, for example, separate those two judicial districts, which have been, you know, combined since at least 1971, and they could say that each judicial district, you know, gets a minimum of at least one representative, and so could, in essence, make sure that that second judicial district gets a member on the board, and the fourth judicial district gets a member on the board, and that is not permitted under the current scheme that the legislature has basically dictated to the board. So I want to give them the ability to have those internal discussions and decide how best they want to conduct those affairs. But right now the legislature is saying, you know, no, we're going to tell you how to do it. So, you know, the question that I would have in response is, does the Bar Association, you know, want the legislature to be, you know, telling them how to conduct their affairs on this? And I want to distinguish that question from you know, how I might want to do it if I was in charge, because I think the amendment is saying that how I want to do it really isn't the point. It's their organization.
Okay. Are there additional questions for folks from the Bar Association? Representative Excellent. Drummond, go ahead.
Actually, this is more of a comment. I'm not sure if I'm understanding the purpose of this amendment, because I'm looking at the list of the membership of the Board of Governors on page one of the auditor's report on this sunset. And I just went through and did the math several times, and it sure appears like there are exactly two members from the board from the first judicial district, four members of the board from the third judicial district, and two members from the second and fourth judicial districts. So I'm not sure I understand the purpose of this amendment, since the organization appears to be self-selecting exactly the way the suggestion in the amendment is. So I'm not going to support this amendment, because I don't understand why it's necessary.
Further questions for the maker of the amendment or for folks from the Board of Governors? Or not just the Board of Governors, from the Bar Association, I misspoke. Representative Eastman.
Well, I still have the same question for each of the Bar Association, and the question isn't I actually like the comments from the bar president a moment ago about, you know, the some of the diversity interests and whatnot, I'm just kind of wanting to know from the Bar Association is, are these decisions best left to the legislature? Because I want to distinguish that from, you know, maintaining whatever scheme the board, you know, has, as opposed to who should have the authority for the decision. That's really the main issue to me, which is inspiring this amendment.
So I actually think, well, Ms. Bailey, you can go ahead and take the first run. I don't think all three are required to speak. You're an organization that actually has a hierarchy. So, Ms. Bailey, Executive Director, you can take the first shot at that.
Thank you, and through the chair, I guess I would comment that I can't speak directly over to who has the authority to make that representation. I can only speak to the amendment that's in front of us. And what that amendment does is it only allows us flexibility when doing proportional representation. So if that were to go into effect, for instance, the second judicial district would never get any representation, because right now the second judicial district only has 24 members. And so, taking into account everything that President Hofmeister said, I would be worried about that. As to the larger question over who should have responsibility, that is something I'm not prepared to talk about, and I don't believe is actually reflected in the amendment.
Any follow-up questions? So that will, there are no questions. Are there any comments from members of the committee as to amendment number one? Representative Kirka.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment.
So we're taking comments now. You got one. Right. Everybody gets one comment, and Representative Eastman gets a wrap-up.
Okay. So I am going to support the amendment. If we're only looking at this, and I have a different amendment, but we'll change that. But if we're only looking at this every 8 years, it seems to me that's a long time to have things locked into statute in terms of the way we're appropriating the board membership across the state. And I think it probably does make sense to have the flexibility with the board. And I guess I disagree with the executive director's reading of the amendment in terms of this is the Board of Governors may, by regulation, allocate the nine attorney members' seats, you know, by proportion. You could still have a scenario where you have at least one member from each judicial district, and then have the rest of them proportional. There's multiple ways to do that. So I support them. I think it's a good idea. I think that the way they're allocated now has, there's some benefits and has some issues. So I support the amendment.
Any other comments as to amendment number one? I've got some comments, and then Representative Eastman, you'll get wrap-up. I note a couple of things. One is that this is a structure that has been in place for 50 years, and it has had multiple opportunities for different legislatures that thought there was something broken with the system to change it. The reasons for having the representation as structured are actually quite logical in terms of trying to make sure that the less represented areas of the state actually have a voice on the Board of Governors, because if we look at the spreadsheet that Representative Eastman distributed, if you had proportional representation on the Board of Governors, it would be overwhelmingly an Anchorage Bar Association. It would have the Anchorage Bar Association essentially running the state bar, and the voice of the smaller communities and the lawyers practicing those smaller communities would be effectively lost. And so I think the legislature was actually very wise when they made a choice to have four members from the third judicial district, which is Anchorage, Kenai, the Mat-Su, two members from the southeast, and two members from northern Alaska, including Fairbanks and western Alaska. The second part is that there's actually a court case, Miller versus Carpinetti, an Alaska Supreme Court case from 2009, that specifically notes that kind of the one person, one vote topic does not apply to the Board of Governors. So the notion that there needs to be proportional representation, our Supreme Court has specifically said that's not required. And there's good reasons for the legislature to have said, we actually want rural areas of Alaska to be carefully considered. Another reason that I think it makes sense is that unlike Mason's manual that we follow here, the Board of Governors operates under Robert's Rules, and under Robert's Rules, the president of the board only votes if their vote makes a difference. So on most issues, the president doesn't vote. And so if you had one person from Southeast Alaska, which would proportional representation would bring you, or one person from the 4th Judicial District, Fairbanks, which was what proportional representation would give you, on many occasions, people from those regions would actually not get a vote on issues taken up by the board. I would note to the extent, and it's not an amendment here and hasn't been offered, but it's interesting that currently the three public members are all from the 3rd Judicial District in Anchorage. And so if we were really trying to improve some proportional representation, we might consider an amendment. It's not here before, and I'm not offering one. We might be considering an amendment that requires the governor to apportion his seats on the Board of Governors so that other areas besides Anchorage are represented, but that's currently not the case today. So for all those reasons, I think this is an amendment that's looking for a problem that doesn't exist, and I urge a no vote on amendment number one. In wrap-up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I am listening and appreciate all the comments, both from the Bar Association and the members. And based on those comments, I want to clarify what the amendment is intended to do. And I'll do that with a conceptual amendment. So I'd like to introduce conceptual amendment number one, which would be on line 9, page 2 of the amendment. And after each judicial district, they would insert a comma and then the words subject to a minimum number of board members from each judicial district.
I'm going to object to the conceptual amendment.
Thank you. And the reason the conceptual amendment is necessary.
Representatives, I'm going to give you a very short time on this conceptual amendment. I think bringing it up during wrap-up is really pushing the process and really on the margins of wasting our time, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, I wouldn't have known that it was necessary until I'd heard the comments from the other committee members. And the reason that this amendment is being offered is to ensure that the board maintains the ability, which they have right now by our edict, but maintains the ability going forward to make sure that they have some level of minimum representation from each judicial district, both from the 2nd and the 4th, specifically since those are smaller, as well as the 1st Judicial District. Certainly, it's not my intent that the whole board become, lopsided in the opposite direction of whatever district happens to be biggest gets to have all the members of the board. That is not what I'm looking for when this amendment is being drafted.
All right. Thank you very much. Any further discussion as to the conceptual amendment? Representative Kirka.
I guess I have a question for folks from the Board of Governors right now. Would that solve their concern with the amendment?
Ms. Bailey? I think they've said they don't think the amendment's necessary. So, go ahead, Ms. Bailey.
Through the chair, again, I don't think an amendment is necessary. As I mentioned, if the desire is to reflect the changing times, our numbers show that the times haven't changed that much and that the number of active attorneys in each judicial district has been very consistent over the past 20 years. So I don't think a proportional response is needed at this time.
Comments as to the conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chairman, that didn't really answer my question. I was asking about the amendment to the amendment, which makes it less proportional and makes it guarantee that each district would have at least one representative, which speaks directly to the executive director's concern.
Representative Kirk, you may feel she didn't answer the question. I think she did. I think your answer was that we don't need the amendment. We don't need the amendment to the amendment either, that the existing structure works very well for the board. I think she answered your question. You may not have liked the answer, but I think she answered it. Other questions or comments as to amendment number one, or the amendment to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, I'll maintain my objection. Madam Secretary, if you could call the roll, I would note for purposes of for purposes of the process, we're supposed to recognize everyone is in the room today. No one is on Teams. Go ahead and call the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kirka?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Snyder?
No.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Chair Klayman?
No.
We have 2 yeas, 5 nays.
And that brings before us amendment number 1. Did you get a different count? I count 3 yeas and 4 nays. By a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, the amendment to amendment number 1 fails. That brings amendment number 1 back before us. If you could call the roll as to amendment number 1.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
No.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Kirka?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative Snyder?
No.
Chair Klayman?
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
So by a vote of 3-4, amendment number 1 has failed. That brings us to amendment number 2, Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 2.
Are you for these?
It matters.
All right, we're back on record. Just for clarity, to the extent there were any misspeaks, that the clerk may have misspoken, amendment number 1, there were 3 yeas and 4 nays. And I think we all agree there were 3 yeas and 4 nays. So amendment number 1 fails by a vote of 3-4. That brings us now to amendment number 2, which has been moved, I believe, by Representative Kirka. And although there was kind of an at ease, at the same time there was an objection, I believe I heard Representative Snyder object.
Yes.
So, Representative Kirka, tell us about amendment number 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number 2 changed the term of the renewable board from 8 years down to 4 years. I think that 8 years is kind of a long time to go between audits and an inspection of what the board has done and how it's conducted itself. And I just think that 4 years would be a lot better time, amount of time for the legislature to come back and examine things rather than wait for another 8 years.
Questions for the maker of the amendment or for members of the Board of Governors or not? Or representatives of the bar, there's only one representative of the Board of Governors here. I did have a question. Can we get an idea of the history of, I know the last renewal was an 8-year renewal. What was the history before that in terms of how long the legislature gave the bar in terms of extensions before the current 8-year extension? If you have that information readily available, and if not.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, are you asking me?
No,
I didn't expect so. Okay.
You know the answer. I'm asking the folks at the bar. Ms. Barry,
go ahead. Through the chair, I do have our last few legislative audits in front of us. I believe the last one was July 11, 2012, November 4, 2008, and November, that was in 2006. So we've had 8-4, and it has varied through over the years. And I believe one of the decisions to make the last one 8 years was that it was found that doing a legislative audit every so often was actually taxing on both legislative staff and on bar staff.
And it looks like Ms. Curtis from Legislative Audit got moved closer to the front, which suggests she has something to add to this. Ms. Curtis, please come forward and you can add to that discussion.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. Just the one point I wanted to make is that up until I think around 2006, the maximum allowed for in statute was 4 years. So please keep that in mind when you're comparing.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Curtis? Yes. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Curtis, for coming forward. So if I heard the executive director correctly, she said it was 4 years between 2006 and the following audit. I didn't write the years down.
Through the chair, I thought she said there was eight. Previous one was eight, and then it was six, maybe four, six, eight.
Okay.
Through the chair, there a lot of things can factor into our recommended term of extension. Obviously, the most important is whether the board is serving the public's interest and whether they should be extended. If a board is serving the public's interest, as legislative auditor, I also look at our workload. You know, we've a ton of boards and commissions, and like this year we're doing eight, next year we're doing three, and we fit these in with available resources, and we have to do the ones that are in statute. We're also working on the financial audit of the state and the state's federal single audit. And then in addition, we perform special audits at the request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee at various topics that the legislature wants us to look at. And so we have these limited resources. So by taking a board that I recommend 8 years and reducing it, that means we'll have additional resources earlier on and less resources available to do other things at the request of the legislature. Another point is that there is a cost to the legislature for audits. Now, that's one way to look at it. We do have we calculate our hourly rate, and we do figure out how much we spend on each board. The hours that we spend on a fairly clean board can run from 350 to 550 hours to complete an audit. We have an average rate right now of about $80 an hour. So there is a cost to performing this oversight function.
Follow-up?
Representative Drummond.
Since your office performs all of these audits, is there an average length, or is there a fixed length, or is 8 years an average length? I have literally not paid attention to the time period that passes each time one of these comes before us, but it seems to be the topic of discussion right now. So, and you're the expert.
Right, through the chair. There is no average. I look at patterns. Last year we had more than half of them received an 8-year extension. I had one that received a 2-year extension. So it varies for a lot of reasons. This board, fairly well run, no serious concerns. They get an 8-year extension, in my opinion.
Representative Drummond.
So it depends on, it literally depends upon your findings. And if you found that there were a lot of issues that the organization that you were auditing had to take care of in your audit, then you recommended a shorter period before the next audit took place. And with no major issues with this organization, you're recommending. And is 8 years the maximum length that you recommend between audits and sunsets?
Yes, Representative Drummond, through the chair. That is the maximum allowed for in statute. But if I have a board that has a few administrative findings, nothing I think is significant, but I know that 8 years from now I've got 10 audits, I'll recommend 7 just to smooth the workload. So it's not a cut and dry. There's other things that come into, you know, managing the projects.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Curtis while she's here before she goes back to the... Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions or comments? Actually, any questions about the amendment? And so I'll ask comments as to amendment number 2. And Representative Kirker, you'll get a wind-up. Anyone with comments? I don't see anyone else. I will just note that in addition to the legislative audit supervision, that the Bar Association very much is run under the supervision of the court system, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why, or not just the court system, but the Supreme Court, and so that's one of the reasons why I think they have a long history of doing very well on the audits and running a pretty tight ship. I do think the 8-year recommendation from the legislative audit is reasonable, so I don't support amendment number 2. So Representative Kirker, in wind-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still think that 8 years is a long time. I understand the workload is an issue, and I appreciate the auditor's comments. It's very helpful. But I think we have responsibility to our constituents, and having that opportunity every 8 years is it's a big separation of time. So I really think we should go back to having it at 4 years like it was previously.
Okay. So that brings us to a roll call. Madam Clerk, if you could call the roll on amendment number 2.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative Kirka?
Yes.
Representative Snyder?
No.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Currently out of the room.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Chair Klayman?
No.
We have 3 yeas, 3 nays.
And so by a vote of 3-3, amendment number 2 has failed. That brings... Hold on, I gotta find my script. That brings House Bill 109 back before the committee for final comments. As usual, I'll give members of the committee 3 minutes per member, and I'll go around the room, and I apologize if I've lost track of where I should be starting, but I'll start with Representative Vance.
No comments at this time.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
I appreciate the work that the association has done in working with the legislature on the audit. I understand from the association that some of the recommendations from the audit have already been achieved, so very grateful for that. And hopefully any of the recommendations that haven't been achieved yet, they'll continue to work on and hopefully get back to us with some kind of update whenever that takes place. Thank you.
Representative Kirka.
Not this time.
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
No comment.
Representative Snyder.
No comment.
Representative Drummond.
Same.
And I would just note that I appreciate all the excellent work the Bar Association does. I appreciate the audit and the reflection that the last 8 years have gone well, and support the bill. So, Representative Snyder, may I have a motion?
I move version 32-LS0592/A of HB 109 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 109 moves from committee. I would ask members to please sign the paperwork as we work through our second order of business today. Second order of business is House Bill 62. Marriage Witnesses, sponsored by my office. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is my staff, Sophie Jonas. Ms. Jonas, if you could please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Sophie Jonas, and I am staff to Representative Klayman. Thank you for hearing House Bill 62. This bill would eliminate the two-witness requirement currently required at marriage ceremonies. At present, during the solemnization of marriage, couples must assent to marriage in the presence of each other, the person solemnizing the marriage, and at least two additional witnesses. Afterward, all parties must sign the marriage certificates. House Bill 62 would eliminate the requirements of any additional witnesses at the marriage solemnization and the signatures of these witnesses on marriage certificates in an effort to help support Alaska's destination wedding industry while preserving the integrity of marriage solemnizations. Alaska is one of 20 states that require two wedding witnesses. 24 states and the District of Columbia do not require wedding witnesses at all. Wedding witnesses play the more critical role in past centuries when record keeping was less automated. Today, however, the role of a wedding witness is largely ceremonial. In Alaska, while the person solemnizing the marriage must meet certain criteria, the law does not require any form of witness verification. Destination weddings are a growing business in Alaska, especially as couples opt for small, intimate ceremonies rather than large ones due to risks associated with COVID-19. But the requirement of two wedding witnesses makes Alaska a less attractive location for destination weddings and burdens wedding industry professionals, who are often tasked with asking friends or family to witness the weddings of their out-of-town clients. And finding witnesses for out-of-town clients has proven to be especially hard during the COVID-19 pandemic. The two-witness requirement can also place increased financial strain on couples seeking to do destination weddings, as they must pay the costs of transportating their witness to the wedding location. Destination weddings bring in an estimated $1 million in revenue to Alaska each year. This revenue figure doesn't consider the fact that more than 90% of out-of-state couples who come to Alaska to get married end up staying for days or weeks to explore our great state. House Bill 62 will help Alaska's tourism industry by allowing Alaska to compete more directly with states like Hawaii and Florida, which lead the nation in destination weddings. And just a brief sectional analysis of the bill, Section 1 of the bill amends AS 25.05.301 by eliminating the requirement of two witnesses at marriage solemnization ceremonies. Section 2 amends AS 25.05.321 by eliminating the requirement of the two witness signatures on marriage certificates. Section 3 removes language from AS 25.05.361 to conform with changes made in Section 1. And finally, Section 4 repeals subsections A3 and A5 of AS 25.05.041 to conform with changes made in Section 1. We now have a short testimonial video that we will be showing, and we ask committee members to hold their questions until after the video. Thank you.
That we were looking to have. Thankfully, the photographer's dad, he was in town for his own personal vacation, and he offered to come along with us to be that witness. We hated to impose on his time, his vacation, visiting with his son. And, you know, it was a little weird for us, but we're really thankful that he offered to come along and do that and take that weight off of us. I think it would take a lot off of future brides that were looking to come to Alaska and get married if you could omit the requirement to have the two witnesses. We loved our time in Alaska, and we can't wait to visit again this year in August for our 1-year anniversary. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Thomas, and this is my lovely new bride, Mitzi. We flew up for helicopter elopement to Alaska, and Chugach Photography was great, coordinated everything for us. Everything was super easy. The only hiccup really was having to have a witness to sign the documents, but other than that, two witnesses, and everything else is very smooth.
Back at the helicopter place, it just kind of would have been a lot better to do it all out here by the glacier on February 21st, 2021.
Hi, my name's Hannah Jacob.
And I'm Mike Banfield.
Last year, we had to make the difficult decision of canceling our traditional wedding with our friends and family up in Alaska. Given that I'm born and raised in Alaska, it was always my dream to have an Alaska wedding.
On July 11th, we woke up early and we met Joe at the Hatcher's Pass Reed Lakes Trailhead. We hiked for 3 hours in the rain until we found the perfect spot between upper and lower Reed Lakes. It was everything we imagined our wedding would be. The rain turned out to be a blessing, and we were largely alone in an amphitheater of mountains.
Finding witnesses to sign our marriage license in such a remote and beautiful area was the only complicating factor we came across. It would have been one less thing to worry about if it wasn't a requirement.
Removing this requirement would reduce the stress on other couples and allow them to have a worry-free backcountry elopement only Alaska can offer.
Hello, my name is Brent, and this is my wife, Andrea Lobo-Kravitz. And in 2020, we took a trip to the Chugach State Forest to elope and provide a bright spot in our otherwise tumultuous year of 2020.
Since we were coming from New York City, we didn't know anyone in Alaska, and since we were eloping, we weren't bringing anyone out from our state, and so we ran into a little bit of an issue pretty early on in the wedding planning process, trying to find two people who could sign our marriage license. Eventually, we did find two people who worked at the helicopter company, and we were able to get them to sign our license. It was a little bit less than ideal because we didn't really know them, and as well, we did have to have our wedding ceremony in the helicopter company's office instead of on the beautiful glaciers that we had come to see.
We really enjoyed our time in Alaska, and we really want other couples to experience the opportunity to get married in that great state. And of course, it would always be better if you could get married on the glacier as opposed to in the helicopter office. We had a wonderful time, and we very much look forward to coming back in the future. So thank you very much.
Hello, my name is William Oates. I am here in my home state of New Mexico with my good friend Denali here, who was named to honor and mark the occasion that my wife and I just shared and experienced in your beautiful state of Alaska, in which we did travel there and elope with Joe and Chugach Peaks Photography. It was truly an unbelievable experience. And I really think that the only detractor from it really was to step kind of out of the intimacy and fluidity of that entire experience to enter in a bit of a more bureaucratic mode and sort of dot I's and cross T's to establish our witnesses and satisfy that requirement of your state. I think that if that could be remedied, it's well worth consideration so that others like ourselves would be more willing maybe to have the type of experience that we did to travel to your state and hopefully witness and experience the wonders like Colony Glacier and flying out of Girdlewood and everything that you have to offer. So thank you for your time and consideration. Have a great day. Thank you.
I would note that we also have actually a brief at ease. Back on record. We also have two invited witnesses that would like to testify, so we'll go ahead and take the invited testimony, and then we'll take questions from the committee. First invited testimony from Kian Mulhern with Celtic Ministries. Mr. Mulhern.
Hello, this is Reverend Kian.
Yes, go ahead and proceed. Identify yourself for the record, anyone you're affiliated with, and you can proceed with your invited testimony. Try to limit that to 2 minutes.
Sure. My name is Reverend Kian Mulhern. I'm with Celtic Ministries out of Wasilla, Alaska. I've been performing weddings for over 21 years, many different states, quite a few of those not needing witnesses. And I can say this. There's a lot of different opinions about a bill like this, but it comes down to one thing. the couple is not taking this wedding and their marriage more seriously the day of, afterwards, or in the next 20, 30, 60 years because they had two witnesses there. That does not change how the couple feels that day, nor 10 years from that day. So for anybody to sit there and say that because of two witnesses, it's making the wedding itself more legitimate, that's incorrect. For people to say that there needs to be competent witnesses there, who is to say what witness and what person is competent? I would never want to make that judgment. I'm not a psychiatrist. But to sit there and talk about witnesses having to be, it has to be just this one way, is a little bit out of the realm of what weddings are in 2020. Like I said, it doesn't mean that it's any less than it was, and it doesn't mean that it's any more than. Are there any questions?
If you'll stand by, if folks have questions, we'll go ahead and let Mr. Connolly talk next in his invited testimony, and then after that we'll take questions, and they may ask questions as we go forward. Mr. Connolly, if you want to identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your invited testimony. I'd ask you limit that to 2 minutes.
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Connolly. I'm the owner and a photographer at Chugach Peaks Photography, which is based in Anchorage. Thanks for hearing House Bill 62. As the person who brought this matter to Representative Clayman's attention, I really value this opportunity to give some thoughts on the intent of the bill. And I'd like to really emphasize that the purpose of this bill is only one thing: eliminate the outdated and unnecessary burden of two witnesses being present to make a wedding ceremony legal. This bill does not change the value of marriage, the sacredness of marriage, the importance of marriage, or the definition of marriage. It simply makes it easier for two people to commit to each other without government forcing random strangers into their ceremony. This bill does not make a wedding ceremony less serious or will lead to higher divorce rates. The value and success rate of a marriage is not determined by how many people are present at the wedding ceremony. As my representative, James Kaufman from District 28, so well posted on his Facebook recently, we should be passing bills that add value to lives and protect liberty. There are so many antiquated and intrusive bills. Now we have a chance to fix one. This bill removes text from a bill and makes it easier for people to get married. And the fact is, Alaska is becoming a destination wedding location. That may sound crazy to you, but I can assure you that thousands of people are coming to Alaska each year. I hope you enjoyed some of the firsthand testimonials from a few of the clients that we worked with recently, from remote flyout locations such as glaciers to quiet and secluded private spaces in our state and national parks. I photographed thousands of weddings all over the state. Not all the weddings we do are big, elaborate affairs that everyone's accustomed to, with long guest lists and mediocre buffet food. Often it's just two people who want a private ceremony where the focus is on their love and their relationship and the beautiful place that they chose to get married. Often they travel alone and prefer that no family or friends are present. That should be their right. And even if they choose that path, the state should not then force strangers to be present in lieu of their family or friends. As our state struggles with diminishing returns in the oil market, new tourism opportunities should be embraced. We should encourage these small destination weddings and the tourist dollars that follow.
You can conclude your remarks. That would be great.
Yep. States like Hawaii and Florida see the highest numbers of destination weddings in the country, and it should be no surprise that they don't require witnesses. There are 30 states that do not require any witnesses: Texas, Montana, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Idaho, Indiana, Tennessee, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and many more. There's no reason to have a witness that doesn't change the value of the ceremony.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. If we have questions, we'll let you know. Questions from members of the committee? And I just want to note that some of the committee members have actually heard this bill in state affairs, so I'm going to – that would be Representative Christ-Tompkins, Representative Vance, and Representative Eastman. So I will give some priority to those that haven't heard this bill before. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I assume – this question is – I guess it's for Mr. Connolly. Mr. Connolly, I guess it was you that provided that video of the various couples. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I was actually surprised that the did I hear correctly that the one couple who spoke to us from a city street in the dark actually, or at night, they actually had to have the ceremony performed in the helicopter office rather than in the location that the that they hired the helicopter to fly them to?
Correct. So the thought is, you know, you're supposed to have two witnesses present, and I'm not going to say who or if this has actually happened, but some people have just gone ahead and done it on the glacier without the two witnesses present. That may or may not have happened. But in this case, these people did not feel comfortable doing that. So rather than doing that, they actually had the ceremony, the legal part of it, in the helicopter office, which you can imagine is a sterile, it's an airport, you know, hangar. Mm-hmm. And it's not very meaningful. It's not very romantic. It's just a sterile airplane hangar. And that way we had two witnesses present. They felt good about it being legal. And then we went and did more of a spiritual ceremony on the glacier after we did the legal ceremony.
Follow up?
Representative Drummond.
So in other words, so the people in the helicopter that actually participated in the spiritual ceremony on the mountain, what I assume it was yourself as the photographer, the couple, two people, and a minister
the pilot.
The pilot. And who performed?
So in the state of Alaska, you don't have to have a minister marry you. You can
have a friend
or a family member or any legal, elected official, or you can have a one-day appointed license. So a pilot can get a one-day appointed license, or an elected official can do it as many as they want. Or you can have a friend or family, like an uncle or a father or somebody like that do it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Kirkup. I have you in the queue, Representative Eastman. I'm just giving the newbies a shot. Representative Kirkup, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to the testifier we're talking about, I apologize, I forgot his name, to the chair. So this is, I know various people in the wedding industry, and I'm surprised that this is, I guess, a huge need to encourage the wedding industry. It seems like I didn't think this was an impediment. How many, in your experience, for these destination weddings out in the sticks or on the glacier or wherever, remote picturesque locations, how many folks actually sign the legal documents where they're getting the photos taken versus signing them in the office or the hangar or the, you know, like, for example, at my wedding 8 years ago now, we got married in a church, traditional in that sense, but it was hours later that we signed the legal documents. It's in the same building, but it was hours later. It wasn't at the moment we gave the vows. So I guess I don't see the necessity. If the testifier could speak to his experience with seeing people sign legal documents at the photo shoot or at where they give the vows.
This bill is not talking about where to sign the legal documents. This bill is talking about how many witnesses need to be present at the actual ceremony. So whether you sign the documents at a glacier, in an office, you know, in your apartment, wherever you're at, your hotel room, that's irrelevant. The question is, do we need to bring additional people to the actual ceremony in a remote location to make it a legal ceremony? So if we have a helicopter that seats four people, you have your pilot, maybe a photographer, and then a bride and a groom. When you fly out there, you cannot legally perform that ceremony. So if the pilot marries them, I can sign as one witness, but because there is two witnesses required, we cannot legally conduct the ceremony on the glacier. We may conduct the ceremony on the glacier, and we may sign it later and have somebody sign as a witness that wasn't there. Like I said, we may or may not ever do that, but that's not a legal ceremony at that point. So we are trying to find a way to remove the legal requirement that two people be physically present at the ceremony to act as witnesses and use the officiant as, you know, the person who's both a witness and conducting the ceremony. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Follow-up, Representative Kirkup?
Just to clarify, I guess I have to read the statute again, but are you saying that the individual officiating the wedding cannot also be a witness?
Correct. The person officiating the wedding itself cannot be a witness. I mean, they're acting in the capacity of a witness and a judgment of character, essentially, because they're marrying them. But in the current form, the state of Alaska requires two additional witnesses that must be physically present in order for the ceremony to be a legally binding ceremony. My argument and point is two witnesses should not be required physically present because you have the officiant, the person actually marrying them, there to witness it as well. And there are 30 states currently, both Republican and Democrat states, that have zero witness requirements. So this isn't like Alaska's jumping, you know, out of the norm and trying to do something that's never been proven. Montana, Florida, Idaho, all these other places don't have any witness requirements.
All right, I'll turn to Representative Eastman. Representative Kirkley, you can always get back in the queue if you have other questions. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't believe that the testimony we're engaging with right now was offered in a previous committee. But I do remember witnesses testifying that marriage has been conducted where there was a witness and the solemnizing official also signed as the second witness. So I know that's been done in some cases. My question,
not in Alaska.
My question to the witness is
for Mr. Connolly.
Yes.
Okay.
I want to say that is not the case in Alaska. The officiant cannot act as a witness.
Yes. Well, I'm just referring to the testimony that was given in our previous committee, not necessarily to your interpretation right now. My question, and it would be open to each of those who are testifying, is there likewise objection to maintaining two witness signatures on the documentation, or is the objection solely to those who are participating in the physical ceremony? And I want to just distinguish those two aspects. Obviously, I register the objection to two witnesses being present to the ceremony. Is there also objection to the documentation having two witnesses after the fact?
So I'll answer that first.
Hold on, I'll let you answer the question, but I just wanted to ask, are you suggesting, Representative Eastman, that we might, through amendment, try to craft this so that a couple could go up on the glacier with the pilot and the person performing the ceremony and a photographer, and then when they fly back down, two people that weren't up on the glacier would sign the document saying that they know the people that got married really wanted to get married even though they didn't see the ceremony? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm curious first what the witness testimony is, but I think one of the things that I would look at is the documentation itself being signed whenever it ends up being signed. When somebody is signing a marriage license, that seems kind of official and formal, and even when that happens separate from a marriage ceremony, there might still be utility in maintaining in statute a requirement that that document, whenever it's signed, does have legal competent witnesses.
Mr. Connolly, you can answer the question. I'm still not quite clear about the question myself, which is why I asked the clarity.
I think our Representative Eastman's going with this. I'll try and answer it. Beth, again. So when I first envisioned this bill, contacted Representative Klayman and explained to him the situation. My initial thought on this was leave the marriage license as it is. Right now there's two blank spots on the marriage license that allow for witnesses. My suggestion would be to leave those two blank places. If somebody chooses to have two witnesses to honor their family members who are there, because a lot of people do have their family and friends there, they can do that. However, in the event that you have somebody that's traveling up from Texas or New York or wherever, and they choose not to have two witnesses, then the marriage license is still processed and the marriage is still considered legal and valid in the state of Alaska without those two signatures. So we're not discouraging people from having witnesses, and we're not telling people that they cannot have witnesses, but we're giving them the choice, rather, to either have them or not have them. And the marriage would still be legal in the eyes of the state, and the license would still be processed equally.
And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. That seems to make actually good sense to me. I think I would support that. My question is a little bit after that. So after the ceremony, after the witnesses, whether there are witnesses or not, Is there any reason that we wouldn't require, you know, when you're going to get your marriage license document, that, you know, your signature at that point should not be witnessed?
So the people getting married, their signatures are witnessed by the person performing the ceremony. Prior to COVID, one of the people would actually pick up the marriage license, whether it's a bride or a groom, would pick up the marriage license at the State Bureau of Vital Records office, and one of them would sign in person at the Bureau of Vital Records, and then the other person would sign in front of the marriage commissioner or pastor or reverend or whoever it was that married them. And that served as, you know, a check. You know, the person performing the ceremony is presumably somebody that can attest to the fact that they got married, because obviously they married them. And so the witness requirement is kind of, you know, unnecessary. It's also antiquated. The whole purpose, Representative Klayman might have mentioned this previously in the first hearing, but the whole purpose was due to the lack of the church's ability and the state or the country's government back in England to properly maintain documents. And I think the state of Alaska and every other state in this country that doesn't have a marriage witness requirement does a pretty good job of maintaining their records. And in the event that they didn't, there's certainly probably a lot of cell phone photos at the very least showing that the ceremony took place. I think just about everybody who's ever been married has probably at least done one or two cell phone photos, if nothing else. So the witnesses in the current form provide no actual, you know, benefit. We could literally write on there Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse, or you could write Abraham Lincoln or anybody that doesn't actually exist, and nobody would know and nobody would check it because there's no auditing and there's no verification of the people who are actually listed on the marriage license itself. So it's probably best to have the person performing the ceremony, who's actually for sure there, write in their approval essentially by signing the document.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
It's just a comment, having heard this in two legislatures and two committees in each legislature. This is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard state government do. It reminds me of my first legislature cattle branding registration, and Speaker Chenault then repealed that. It was some old law from the, like, 1960s and 70s. And the only thing this does is cause complication in people's lives that they don't want. And just the sooner we can dispense of this and get rid of this requirement, the better.
That's more comment than a question, but and we're trying to do questions. Representative Drummond, are you? Is this a comment or a question?
This is a question from Mr. Connolly that I could have asked earlier. It's just a practical question. I assume that it costs a certain amount of money per hour or per however you contract for a helicopter to hire a 4-seater helicopter for the officiant, the pilot, and the couple, versus the cost of a 6-seater helicopter if you had to take those two witnesses to the top of the mountain with you. Do you know what the difference is in that cost, assuming you have ridden in different size helicopters as a result of your business of wedding photography?
Yeah. So this is Joe again. So There is definitely an increased cost. There are three models of helicopters that we generally fly. There's a 4-seater, a 5-seater, and a 6-seater. That's an R-44, R-66, and an A-Star. The bigger one is considerably more expensive, twice as expensive. And the problem that we see is that the cost is so much greater. I mean, we're talking the difference between $1,500 and $3,000, or $3,000 and $6,000, depending on how much time the people go out, that rather than the helicopter companies making more money, they just don't do it. So this isn't like, oh, the helicopter companies would rather people keep bringing more and more witnesses. The fact is, the couples just decide not to do it. So rather than spending more money in our state and into our tourist economy, they just spend less. And they say, well, we'll just get married in the helicopter office and use a smaller helicopter, which is really unfortunate because, you know, if they want to do it legally, they should be able to go do it up in the mountains and do it on a glacier or, you know, some beautiful place. They shouldn't be standing in an airplane hangar on the side of a runway, just to make it legal so that the state of Alaska, you know, recognizes it. The helicopter cost is greater the bigger it is, and a few people have spent the money to get the bigger helicopter, but the majority of them figure out a way to not do that, and that might be getting married in a field next to the airport, or they get married inside the airport hangar, or, again, I'm not going to say if this has happened for sure or not, but some people just do it and sign, you know, Donald Duck or something on the license because nobody checks it anyway. Which, going back to your cattle branding analogy, it's kind of the same thing. You can write anything on there and nobody checks it, nobody cares, which makes the whole thing kind of invalid and pointless.
So, Representative Drummond, I'm going to give you one more question. Representative Vance, I see you've got a question, but before we go to Representative Vance, I'm going to open public testimony so we can open the public
Chairman.
Testimony
Mr.
today.
Mr. Connolly didn't actually answer my question. I just asked, what is the cost of a four-seater as opposed to a six-seater? Hourly rate?
Well, I did say that.
Whatever.
I did say that.
So
I didn't hear him say
different
it.
Rates, $1,500. So if you're going to do an R44 for, say, like 1.5 hours, it's about $1,500. To go to a six-seater, it's about $3,000 for the same thing. So there's different amounts of time. There's three different helicopters, but you can assume that it's about double the cost, $1,500 to $3,000. Or if you were originally going to do $3,000, it's now going to cost you $6,000 for the same thing for a bigger helicopter.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Connolly. Appreciate it.
So I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 62. I see no one in the room that would like to provide public testimony, and we have no one online seeking to provide public testimony. We have had two people provide invited testimony. I would note that Nancy Mead from the Alaska Court System is here for questions, but not for public testimony, and Rebecca Topol, the Chief of Health Analytics and Vital Records from Department of Health and Human Services in Juneau, is also available to answer questions, but seeing or hearing no one else, I'll close public testimony on House Bill 62. And Representative Vance, I've got about 5 minutes, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been listening to the testimony yet again, and you know, you and I have talked about this piece of legislation, and I'm one of those who feels that the two witnesses is highly significant. But I'm looking at the bill, and on page 1, line 10, it says, about halfway through, at the time of the ceremony, the person solemnizing the marriage shall complete the certification. And I think that might be the difficulty, the legal challenge to some of the complaints that have come that says that the people, the witnesses, have to be there at the original ceremony for this certificate to make it fully legal. And I feel like that is more of the challenge versus the two witnesses. And I looked up definitions on uslegal.com as we're sitting here, just regarding the word solemnization. And it says, the solemnization of marriage, no particular form is required except the parties must declare in the presence of a judge, a minister, or the attending witnesses that they take each other as husband and wife. It says, in every case, there shall be at least two witnesses present besides a person performing the ceremony, and they cite. And so I think kind of the challenge that we have in our minds is separating a religious, spiritual, formal ceremony and the legal action of having two witnesses that after the ceremony can say, do you take each other as husband and wife in front of two witnesses? And they say, yes, yes, we do. And I believe that that could fulfill the legal requirement that says these people are serious about this, this is legitimate, and still meet the legal obligation. But I believe that if we amend line 10, that would solve a lot of the problem here without disrupting the legalities of clarifying that people certainly need to prove that they're committed to this. Because I've mentioned before, there's a lot of legal benefits to marriage, and not to be confused with the ceremony and the institution of marriage. I'm speaking to the legal definitions and the benefits that we provide legally, which us as lawmakers have to look at.
Sounds like we're getting into comments and not questions. And Representative Vance, this is not the last time we'll hear this bill. I would actually know that you and I should try to meet here in the next. If our floor schedule allows, we should try to meet, because I think we had an issue we were going to try to talk with Jerry Anderson from Ethics with regard to your interest about disclosure and gifts.
Yes.
So we should try to make a point of discussing that or meeting about that here, not during this committee meeting. But these are interesting challenges. We're about 1 minute to three, and so we're going to continue to hold House Bill 62 for further review, and I would note that amendments are due electronically by 5 p.m. on Friday, March 26th for this bill. And I would, that's the deadline we're announcing now. I would note that I know we've got floor scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, which I think we're taking up amendments to House Bill 76. And if it turns out our floor schedule becomes more time consuming, please let me know, because I would certainly consider a request that we add a little more time for amendments if our floor schedule starts getting a lot more involved than, I mean, I just can't predict the floor schedule. So that's just an output. Our current deadline for amendments is going to be Friday at 5 o'clock electronically. Our next meeting is Monday, March 29 at 1 p.m. Again, if you're considering an amendment to House Bill 29 or House Bill 62, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Friday, March 26th. It's my current intention to take up amendments to both House Bill 29 and House Bill 62 during our meeting on Monday, and then pass the bills out of committee following final questions and discussion. So please plan to attend Monday's meeting as necessary to sign the paperwork. And with that, we will stand adjourned. I show the time as 2:59 p.m.